Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Welcome to Head On with Bob Kincaid. Bear with us, and we'll be on in just a moment.
Just to let you know what's going on, welcome. I'm about 50 minutes late for the program this evening, so I hope you'll forgive that. But there's a little bit of a technical hitch and glitch, and it's been a heck of a day, but we're going to get started in about 10 minutes here. We're on the campus of West Virginia State University in Institute, West Virginia, and we are here for the Seneca II Lecture Series. We've been here before for several others. Ray McGovern was here last. That was rather an abortive attempt because of some technical problems here on the university's end. Before that, we've also talked with this is why you bring notes to these things. But this is, I think, our fourth trip to the Seneca II Lecture Series with the Head On Radio Network. We will be videoing. We will be audioing, and we will be providing full multimedia, full spectrum multimedia for this event. You are welcome to listen in. Tonight is David K. Johnston. He's the author of Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, both of them brilliant. I've already met him. Brilliant exposés of what is being done to the American people via the American tax code. Oh, no, not the tax code, you say. But it turns out that, as he understands it, this is scintillating stuff. So that's what we've got going on. Agnes, if you're hearing me, shoot me a note. Let me know. I show that I'm streaming. I would like to have some affirmation of that. That would be nice to have, just to know that I'm not sitting here babbling away. We'll be getting started, like I said, in about 8 minutes or so. We'll hear from a number of people, and then Mr. Johnston, who is a reporter for the New York Times, will start up. And I think we're going to have rather an excellent evening. So cross your fingers. All right, I'm getting some confirmation from Agnes that we are on the air. That's always a bonus. You wouldn't believe what my God, it looks like the bridge of the Starship Enterprise here. But this is a nice sign because it shows that we're going to be able to do what we need to do, assuming everything works out and we wind up in Denver. We'll be doing this again tomorrow night, by the way, with an entirely different audience at the campus of Concord University, Beckley. Mr. Johnston will be speaking there as well. He'll be fielding questions tonight. We could be here for a while, in other words. Peter Godbold's program, his internet has been dicey and splicey and splotchy today, so it's possible we may just go over a bit. We may preempt Peter's time a little bit, but I think it'll be time that is well worth spending. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go dark for a little bit. And then the next voices that you hear will be those of the folks with Seneca II Lecture Series. And then a couple of one other speaker. Let me see if I've got the name here. Eva Knapp will be the moderator. You will hear her first. And then you'll hear an introduction, and then you'll hear David K. Johnston. Coming up in the future, October 30th, Rabbi Arthur Waskow. So I have a feeling that's going to be very much a very engaging conversation as well. So here we go, huh? All right, I'm going dark. Welcome to the program. I hope you enjoy it as much as we enjoy bringing it to you. And the next sound that you will hear will be even that. So stand by. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice, America's listener-supported Liberal Voice, the Head-On Radio Network. You're listening to The Horn live from the campus of West Virginia State University in Institute, West Virginia.
Hello, this is Bob Kincaid, Jr., and we are live.
Okay, we're about to get started, but I've got to blow your mind. I feel like I need a shower. Just a matter of seconds ago, none other than Don Blankenswine walked within 6 inches of me with his dirty little pencil-thin mustache. I don't know what that pig's doing here, but he is. You copy? Okay, we're going to be getting started in a sec. Of course, you know, if you have read Mr. Johnston's book, you know that he's calling BS on a lot of the loopholes and a lot of the corporate tax dodges that are front and center of the American ripoff. So now the head coal thug himself is here.
Seneca 2 would like to take this occasion to honor the women who summoned the Seneca Falls Convention 160 years ago this weekend. A group of Quaker and abolitionist women made history by seeking to make the wrongs right in our country. Seneca 2 takes its name and its inspiration from these women. And now, on behalf of Seneca 2, West Virginia State Political Science Department, and West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy, welcome to our forum. We're happy you could join us this evening. Dr. Chuck Smith of the Political Science Department would like to welcome you also.
I'm not sure why I should get an applause for doing this, but I certainly do want to welcome you here tonight to West Virginia State University. As a member of the faculty and as a member of the faculty of the Political Science Department, we certainly want to welcome you here and encourage you to come to this and future forum that we're going to continue to have here. You'll see in your program that the next one is scheduled and will be in October, and I hope you'll be able to come for that. I'm going to take a little liberty. I said I wasn't going to talk very long, but as many of you who know me very well are tired of hearing, I'm writing a political biography of Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Susan B. Anthony, of course, Elizabeth Cady Stanton was the main catalyst of the first woman's right convention in history of the world in Seneca Falls in 1848. And what a remarkable thing that was. And I think it's really appropriate that these women that I've had the good fortune to be associated with have taken that as their model, because certainly among all the people I'm associated with, I'm very proud to be associated with them and deeply respect the work they do as community activists and also as sponsors of these forums. And so again, thank you very much and welcome and enjoy the evening.
Thank you, Chuck. I'm getting signals in the back that you can't hear. I'll ask our speakers to stand close to the mic and speak directly. See if I can do it. Thanks, Chuck. I'd like now to introduce Robert Dysnoff, a policy analyst at West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy. Robert is a Charleston native and a last-year law student at Miami School of Law, and he'll introduce us to the work done at the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy. Robert.
Thank you for the introduction, Eva. Can you guys hear me okay? All right. Unfortunately, our Ted Bednar, our executive director, was unable to make it tonight. He's out of town for conferences, so I'm here to give a brief overview of our organization. The West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy is a statewide, nonpartisan, nonprofit policy research organization dedicated to informing the public about how state fiscal policy decisions affect all West Virginians, especially low, moderate-income families, other vulnerable populations, and the important community programs that serve them all. Founded in 2007, our center strives to address the issues that concern working West Virginians and their family, and to ensure that their needs are considered during policy debates. We develop policy options to alleviate poverty that are balanced and accessible to non-specialists. For example, our areas of work include promoting the expansion of health coverage among low-income families and children, the development of proposals to create a state-earned income tax credit that would help over 140,000 working West Virginians make ends meet, and the creation of universal retirement accounts that can help employees save for retirement and local businesses cut red tape while improving benefits. Among our recent accomplishments in the state legislature include a combined reporting measure passed in 2007 that closed several corporate tax loopholes and increased state revenue by an estimated $33 million. We've also recently published a primer on the West Virginia state budget process called Your Map to the State Budget. This is a step-by-step guide that explains how the budget's created, where the revenue is raised to fund various state programs. There's free copies available right outside. I encourage you to grab one if you're interested. There's also copies of other free publications, including a report that gives an overview of the state's Medicaid program, one that provides a detailed description of the combined reporting legislation I just mentioned, and one that describes the benefits of public work supports in our state. You can also sign up for Budget Matters Outside, which is our bi-monthly email publication that briefly highlights the latest state economic policy issues and trends in West Virginia. I also just like to say real briefly that we're really excited to be partnering with Seneca 2 and the West Virginia State University Political Science Department to bring you Mr. Johnson, who I really look forward to hearing speak. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, David. Now I'm happy to introduce our speaker, David K. Johnston. I'm sure David is someone you recognize from his many appearances on television and radio, and Seneca 2 is thrilled to have him as a forum speaker. While at the New York Times, David won the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for his running investigation of our tax system. He was also a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2000 and 2003. His previous book, Perfectly Legal, was a New York Times bestseller and was honored as Book of the Year by investigative reporters and editors. Over his 40-year career, he has won many other honors, including the George Polk Award. One biographer says, he has uncovered so many tax dodges that he has been called the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States. Please welcome David K. Johnston.
Well, thank you for coming. Thank you for living in a place where I don't have to put a suit on. And I hope in the next hour or so, while we talk, and I'll take questions from you at the end of this, that I'm able to show you some things about the reasons that you and the people around you, your neighbors, your friends, and people you will never meet, are in the economic circumstances they are today. They are not there because of some natural immutable force. They're there because of the policies of government. And one of the great lessons we've lost in this country is an appreciation of the fact that government plays a very central role in people's lives. Free Lunch, my current book, is essentially about two things. It is about a defense of free markets, or competitive markets, the phrase I prefer to use, from a government which, while spouting that it is in favor of competitive markets, is in fact being used by many of the participants in those markets to put a thumb on the scale, a very heavy thumb on the scale, and to rig markets and to artificially inflate prices and to transfer income and wealth from those with less to those with more. It is, secondly, a book about hidden subsidies or disguised subsidies, sometimes disguised in such a way that even though you may hear about them on television or read about them in the newspaper, you're given no idea what they're really about. Now, this state in particular has been very, very generous to the rich. It's amazing how much this state has been eager to turn over to people who are wealthy. Now, I'm not against subsidies per se, I went to public schools as a small child. That's a form of subsidy from one generation to the next. I pay taxes now so that other people's children can be educated, in no small part because I want to have a competent police officer when one is needed. I want to have a clerk who knows how to make change. It's getting to be more difficult. And I want to live in a society of people who have developed their brains. But the subsidies in this state in particular have been to retail, not to basic research, not to applied research, not to infrastructure that serves everyone, but to retail, the end of the economic chain. So when Cabela's, who I'll talk a fair amount about tonight, their competitor Bass Pro, Walmart, Lowe's, come to town and get something called tax increment financing, or TIF. You may even read in the newspaper, well, there's a new shopping facility being built, and it's going to get tax increment financing. What the heck does tax increment financing mean? It sends you to the dictionary. Well, here's what it means. The sales taxes that the government forces you to pay at the cash register for your goods never gets to the government. Instead, those sales taxes are kept, legally kept, by the owners of the store. Now, of course, it's not quite that simple. They don't get to reach into the cash register and pull out 8%. Instead, here's how it works. I'm Walmart, controlled, by the way, by the wealthiest family in America, or Cabela's, or Target, or Lowe's, or any of the other big box retailers, and I decide I can make a lot of money at this location. Well, somebody owns that location. If I go to them to buy their land, they may well demand a lot of money because they know it's a valuable location. Even if they've got some minor business, they're not dumb. They figure the day will come. They'll cash in. They'll either develop it or they'll sell it. But if I can get the local government to use its power of eminent domain to seize that piece of land for a fraction of its value, I'm ahead. Then I get the government to create an IDA. Now, that does not mean, as has been argued for poor people, an individual development account, some little cash asset for you. It's an industrial development agency. Most places, they're called enterprise zones. I live in New York, so we're special. We call them empire zones. And the empire zone acquires this land, whereupon the land and any structure built on it is removed from the tax rolls in most cases. I don't have to pay property taxes then. I build my store. The sales tax comes in. I don't turn the sales tax over to the regular government authority. I turn it over to the IDA, which uses it to pay the interest on the bonds and to pay off the principal on the bonds. And lo and behold, the taxpayers bought me a store. Now, anybody in this building tonight, retail merchant, own your own business in retail? Okay, well, imagine for a moment, instead of whatever you did when you were young, you decided one day, I'm going to go into business. And you start a little business selling whatever. Fishing flies, imported soap from the Far East, something. And you've built your business up and you're successful. And you're probably going to earn as a profit about 4, 5, or 6 cents out of each dollar that comes in the front door. You bring in $1 million, you're going to make $40,000, $50,000 plus a salary for yourself if you're your own manager. Well, along comes the competition. They get their land at a discount. They get everything paid for by the taxpayers. Well, they make the same nickel that you're making. And then they get 8 cents or so of sales tax. That's 13. And then they get the penny they're not having to spend on property taxes. Lo and behold, they're making a profit of 14%, almost three times your profit. What do you think is going to happen to your business? And yet, how does the news media almost always report these things? They're going to create 250 new jobs through this new business. Well, they're not going to create 250 new jobs. What they're going to do is move 250 jobs to that location, because unless there is real economic growth in the community, a larger population, which means there's more demand for retail, or a big increase in incomes because people have more money to spend, All that subsidy does is transfer the jobs from the existing locally owned merchants to the national chain that got this deal. Now, why would the city fathers do this to destroy their own local burger class, burger with an H, merchant class? Why would the city fathers do that? Well, first and foremost, I argue they would do it because they don't understand the economics of it. They've been talked to by the lobbyists and the salesmen and the agents and those people who are going to make money off the deal in the local community and given a version of it. And on the other side, the local merchants don't know about this. Their associations haven't been out fighting these things because they don't grasp what's happening to them collectively and don't see it as a way to take action, something they need you to defend their interests. And if the quality of the life in your community is significantly dependent on the welfare of the local business-owning class, they're the people who put up money for lots of things, who, because their fortunes are tied to the community, have a vested interest in the health of the community. Whereas if you live in, say, Beverly Hills or Manhattan or Greenwich, Connecticut, or Bentonville, Arkansas, what the heck do you care about how people are doing in West Virginia? You just want to know how much money you're getting every month sent to you from there. The second effect, though, is that if there's no real growth in sales, that all that's happening is sales are occurring at the location that's subsidized instead of the local merchants, and some of those sales are diverted to the big box retailer, that means the schools aren't getting that money. It means the library isn't getting that money. It means the police department isn't getting that money. Read any stories in the paper about shortages of funds for local services by government? Well, guess what? That's because the money that should be providing you with services is making sure that the Walton family has enough corporate jets for the children. That's what's going on here. There's a word for this. It is not capitalism. It is not market economics. This is socialism, corporate socialism. That's what's going on here. Corporate socialism for those at the top and market for everybody at the bottom, people who are least able to stand the risks of a market. Now, Adam Smith, the sort of, some people call him the original economist, he's certainly the guy who figured out market economics in The Wealth of Nations, wrote something very interesting. A lot of people, if they've read Adam Smith, they know the story of pin making and how pins went from being a luxury good of the rich to cheaper than cheap because of specialization and breaking down each task of making a pin instead of, as was done originally, having one worker craft one pin and then go to another one. Well, Adam Smith wrote, "Seldom do members of the same occupation gather together, even for merriment, but the conversation turns into a conspiracy against the public to raise prices." Now, that line gets quoted a lot by people, but what he said that's really important is what followed. It isn't just that the Chamber of Commerce gets together or the National Association of Widget Makers. It's, he then said, "By no means of liberty or justice may such voluntary associations be prevented." Well, you go around and say, "I'm sorry, you're in the both in the dressmaking business, you can't meet, can't talk to each other. I'm not going to do that." But, Smith said, government ought not to do anything to facilitate such gatherings. Well, have you ever noticed, if you turn on C-SPAN, who's on the dais when the National Association of Manufacturers or the Farm Bureau or the automakers or the pharmaceutical industry holds their national conference? You know, you're going to see minor people up there, like the President of the United States, a senator, a governor, a cabinet secretary. The government's deeply involved in facilitating exactly what Adam Smith said not to do. Now, Smith had another great observation. In his day, what we call a subsidy was known as the bounty. And he said, you would think that if you subsidize a business, the profits would be much bigger. And in the case of somebody like the Waltons, who are famed for the efficiency of their business, some would say the ruthless efficiency of their business, they do make very good profits. But he pointed out that in many cases, those people who got a subsidy didn't make any profit at all. He said that in the herring industry where there was a subsidy, often the ship is outfitted not to catch the fish, but the bounty. And the reason many of those going after the subsidy don't make a big profit is because they're not having to husband their own resources. When you've got your own money to put into your business or your home or to invest in something, you think carefully about what you're doing. You may make mistakes, but you tend not to be foolish. But hey, subsidy, other people's money. If I lose it, it didn't cost me anything. You guys got the bill. So what does it invite into a business? Brash adventurers. People who really don't know what they're doing. People who can't make any money in the market. Which leads me to a failed oil and gas shelter tax salesman from Texas by the name of George W. Bush. Now, George Bush moved to Midland, Texas, and went into this business. Selling oil and gas tax shelters requires an enormous amount of detailed knowledge. You've got to know geology. You've got to know the history of the production of fields. You've got to know the market. You've got to know a lot of things. And if there's anything we know about George Bush, it's that details are not his strong suit. And George Bush was miserably unsuccessful in this business, and there have been books written about how he had to be bailed out of it. Well, about the time this happened, and about the time his father moved into 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, an oil man in Texas named Eddie Childs took a look at the calendar, realized he was 89 years old and had better start thinking about finishing up and taking care of all of his affairs before his time ran out. And Eddie had a hobby. He owned a money-losing baseball team called the Texas Rangers. So Eddie put the Rangers on the market, and up stepped some buyers from California and New York to buy the team. And all was fine, except all of a sudden, from nowhere, somebody planted stories in the news media, we can't have Californians owning the Texas Rangers. That would be abominable. We have to have Texans owning the Texas Rangers. And at that very moment, who should step forward but a guy from Midland, Texas, named George W. Bush, who had put together a group of investors to buy the team. And they bought the team. They bought it at a nice low price, too, because it was a money-losing baseball team. Oh, and the money the investors brought, the investors lived in New York and California. Right. Well, here's what they did when they bought that team. This is what makes George Bush, in many ways, the most ironic salesman of all times and arguably the greatest salesman I've ever heard of. They arranged to have a special election held in Arlington, Texas, about a third of a million people midway between Dallas and Fort Worth, to finance the construction of a baseball stadium. And if you're a baseball fan, I got to tell you, it's a great stadium, gorgeous stadium there. But they hold this election. They hire a Democratic firm, because this is a bipartisan issue here. They hire Democrats to come and run the election for them. And about 16 people turn out to vote because it's a January election. And a majority of them vote to raise the sales tax in that city by half a cent. At the same time, they pick the land they want. And in fact, they decide, you know, why should we just take 17 or 20 acres or so for a baseball stadium and some parking? We got big plans. We're going to build hotels and restaurants and entertainment zones. So why don't we get the city to condemn about, 250 acres of land? The city does. One family of owners doesn't want to sell. They have a nice little horse farm. They like their land. They fight back. They can afford to fight back because those of you in the room here with white hair will remember this like me. Their name was the Curtis Mathis family. Anybody remember black and white TVs that were 7 inches wide? That's who made them back then. Well, they got a jury trial over in Tarrant County, the next county over, and the jury awarded them six times the highest offer the city made. And the lesson in that is that if the government comes to get your land, instead of paying you market value or paying you a premium, because after all, you've been holding onto this land expecting to cash out, What government will typically try to do is get that land from you for a tiny fraction of its real cost. So the stadium gets built with taxpayer dollars. The deal is so sweet that you've heard of rent to own. The poor want to get an appliance, you rent to own, and you pay six times the real cost of the washer. And by the way, they sell you not a well-made Kenmore or something, or Maytag. They sell you one that needs a repairman all the time. Well, all the rent they paid and all the money spent on repairs went to pay the bill for the stadium, every dollar. Oh, and they had a ticket tax put on the players, too, to help pay the bill. The total subsidy, according to the public record and a man named Ray Hutchison. Ray Hutchison is a leading Republican insider in Texas. He's married to a U.S. Senator named Kay Bailey Hutchison from Texas. And he is, by all accounts, the leading authority in Texas on municipal bond finance. According to Ray Hutchison, the subsidy was $202 million. Well, 9 years go by. George W. Bush is governor of Texas. They sell the baseball team, and they announce that the sales price is $164 million more than they paid for it. And what does that mean? It means George Bush didn't make one penny off the market. He didn't even capture the entire $202 million subsidy. He is such a skilled businessman, he left $38 million lying on the table. Every penny came from the taxpayers. Now remember, this is President Bush who said it's wrong from the government to take any more from you than it needs. It's your money that should be in your pocket. So you're going to run for president on this as a platform. How do you deal with this contradiction? Well, you get it out 2 years ahead of the election, and you tell reporters who you invite in to have meetings and be close, who are not finance guys, they're not business reporters, this was a win-win for everybody. We got Texans to keep the team. We got a ballpark that was new, and everybody came out ahead. Of course, nobody asks about, well, what about the fact that the vast majority of people never go to a baseball game, but they had to pay higher taxes? What about the little old lady living on a fixed income who had to buy basic supplies to keep herself alive and had to give up one half of 1% of her income so that George Bush could get rich? What about the child who went out and babysat or cut lawns to make some money and wanted to buy comic books or Nintendo games? They had to pay extra taxes. They had money taken out of their pocket. For what? Well, so that George Bush and a bunch of investors from New York and California could get rich. And here's the masterful stroke about this. President Bush borrowed most of the money for his deal. He was given, in addition, because he was the general partner, a 10% interest as compensation. Now, compensation is taxed, you'll notice, at higher rates than capital income. Currently, if you sell something and it's a capital gain in this country, the rate right now, because of President Bush, is 15%. But if you're in the top tier for wage earners, it's 35%, plus a Medicare tax of 2.9%. So you're really paying 38% instead of 15. You save 23 percentage points. President Bush filed his tax return, which I have, and it's online. You can go look it up at the Tax History Museum online. And he reported his entire $17 million gain as a capital gain, not as compensation, because they gave him the shares. That's how they paid him. You know, your employer can pay you in a paycheck every week, but the company could give you shares of stock and say, here, we're giving that instead. Go sell it. That's your pay. So George Bush cheated the government to the amount of about $3.4 million on his tax return. And the year that his tax return would have been selected for audit by the IRS turns out to be the year when, A, the poor were more likely to be audited than the rich, and B, perhaps more importantly, it was the lowest audit rate in history. His chances of being audited were extremely low. He wasn't audited as governor of Texas. And under our system, if you cheat on your tax return and the government doesn't challenge it, guess what? you get to get away with it. And he got away with it. At the minimum, at the absolute minimum, he fudged on his taxes. Now, there's a lesson in this. Lots of people are doing this. It isn't just George Bush. Warren Buffett got $100 million from the taxpayers of the Buffalo area in western New York 2 years ago for an investment that was supposed to create jobs. And how much did that investment cost? $40 million. And how much did the taxpayers give Mr. Buffett? $100 million. He made a $60 million profit right out of the box. We have entire industries in this country that now make all of their profits from these hidden subsidies. On a strict accounting basis, they may not, but the numbers are very clear that that's where the profits are coming from. Commercial sports. Baseball, basketball, football, hockey. According to Forbes magazine, they have operating profits. That's not their net profit. Operating profits. That's a measure of profit. It's before you pay taxes, before you pay for replacing worn-out equipment, things like that. They had operating profits collectively of $1.6 billion. And how much do they get in subsidies from the taxpayers? Congress has been told they get $2 billion. In other words, but for your generosity, commercial sports would be losing over $1 million a day. So every time you think of A-Rod with his $25 million contract per year to play baseball, just remember that you made it possible because of your generosity. Well, the lesson in this is, why compete in the marketplace when you can get the government to give you money? It is easier to mine gold from the public treasury than to take it out of the side of the mountain. And it is a heck of a lot easier than earning it in the marketplace. Indeed, in a truly competitive market, Adam Smith wrote, the profits of a business will be just enough to justify staying in business. They should be very thin. Now think about that when you, if you pick up the business pages of the newspaper and read about all the CEOs who are projecting 15% profit margins, 20% profit margins, 25% profit margins, that are demanding that workers give up their pension plan or cut their health care plan so they can increase their profit margins. 15% is not just enough to justify staying in business. What that number tells you is that's not a competitive market. How can you earn an above-market profit? Well, one way to do it is the one we've all been taught about through time because of the reformers of 100 years ago or 120 years ago, and that's through a cartel, through antitrust actions, through me and you and you and you as business owners getting together and fixing prices. Seldom do members of an occupation gather together, but even for merriment, that's the classic way. But there's a much easier way because the classic way is actually illegal. You might get prosecuted for it. General Electric was prosecuted in the 50s for fixing the prices of appliances. The other way to do it is get the government to do it for you. And by the way, if people are busy not reading the news or demanding that their newspaper tell them what is my government doing, but instead they're rushing home at night to find out who's going to be the next American Idol. Oh, Britney was out last night. Was she wearing underwear? What is she drinking? You just get the government to do it for you. All the job losses going on in America, all the cuts constantly in the news, right? Laying people off left and right. Well, let me tell you the occupation that's growing gangbusters. Anybody young here wants a future until conditions change? Here's a good future for you. The number of lobbyists in Washington has more than doubled since 2000. There are now more than 35,000 registered lobbyists in Washington to influence 435 members of Congress and 100 senators. More than 35,000. And they have a lot of tools to help them do this. They've got corporate jets at their disposal to fly you somewhere to give a talk and spend a lot of time hanging out in the pool, playing golf. We had the famous, you know, $250,000 golf outing for Tom DeLay and other leaders of Congress. I can't even figure out, how do you spend $250,000 on a golf outing? Solid gold golf balls? $250,000. Now, if you're a member of Congress, by the way, think about the situation that you're in. We have created districts, and this is an unusual year, 2008. Don't think about this election. Think in more historic terms. We've created districts that tend to be very heavily D or very heavily R. You know, there are plenty of members of Congress who could run for office if they were dead and get reelected, and it's actually happened a couple of times. Your constituents are not you and me. Your constituents are the donors who put up the money so that you can run for election again. And the ones who do all these other nice things for you. You need to go somewhere, they arrange a corporate jet for you. I actually, in my previous book, Perfectly Legal, quoted a senator from Idaho about how terrible it is to fly in a corporate jet. People have no idea. It's just awful. And maybe they can arrange a job for your wife. You know, Tom Daschle's wife was one of the highest paid lobbyists in Washington when he was the Senate Majority Leader. Or your children. Oh, and the newest gambit of all. No questions raised at the Senate and House Ethics Committees about this one. You're a senator, a congressman, you got to raise money for your election. Just hire your spouse as your campaign manager or development manager and pay them a share of the donations. None dare call it bribery. That's how it works these days. That's how it works. Now, let me give you a couple other examples, and then I'm going to talk about what we can do about it and take questions. How many of you own a house? Keep your hand up. How many of you bought land title insurance? Yeah, all of you. You buy your first house. I remember I grew up pretty poor. I went to work at 10 and full-time at 13, but when I was 22 years old, I bought a house. Wish I still owned it because it just sold for $1 million. And I remember I got this statement and had all these little $10 for this and $5 for that and $25. And all of a sudden, there's a thing for hundreds of dollars. It says ALTA. What the heck? That's title insurance. You have to have land title insurance. Make sure that you're protected in case the next-door neighbor has built something and encroaches 1 inch onto your land. You know, you need to be protected. Well, of course, the person being protected here isn't me, it's the lender. It's the bank that made the mortgage. But here's the real shocker I tell about in free lunch. The insurance commissioner in Colorado noticed that there was land title insurance being sold on brand new homes where there should be no question about the title and that no one after years had filed a claim. So she began asking the question, if no one ever files a claim, why do you need to buy this? And her investigators quickly learned that there is an interconnection and flow of money between the developer and the land title insurance company. The land title companies respond to this very clearly. One of them, according to emails I quote in Free Lunch, set up a campaign to smear this woman, Erin Toll. They even had a very cleverly designed way to plant a question with the news organization, and the head of public relations for one of the land title companies says, and what will happen is that question will prompt news organizations to call us and ask about this. And then we'll be able to get our story out without anybody knowing that we're the ones who set out to smear her. Well, the insurance commissioners in California and Washington State began looking into this, and they found that 90 cents on the dollar of what you pay for land title insurance goes to pay bribes and kickbacks. They're politely called referral fees. One of the land title companies says in its annual disclosure to the federal government and to shareholders, our customers are real estate lawyers, appraisers, real estate brokers and agents. That is, they're the people who steer you to the company. Now, in a large city, if you go to the phone book and you look up land title in the yellow pages, you will see page after page after page of companies, and you would think, boy, talk about a competitive, vibrant market. There's like hundreds of these companies. Well, they're fronts. Five companies control 90% of the market. They just use different little marketing names to make it appear there's a vibrant market. They all charge the same prices. They all pay the same kickbacks. And by the way, what was the response of the insurance commissioners in these states after documenting this conduct, which is criminal conduct? We need to have better education of the insurance industry so that they understand their responsibilities under the law. Well, the King County or Seattle, Washington Board of Realtors is still literally getting a free lunch every month paid for by the land title companies. Government hasn't done anything to stop this. And by the way, of that $1,000 you will pay for these days for land title insurance on a $200,000 home, how much actually goes to pay claims overall statistically? About $25. $25. So even if you double that for overhead, you got your clock clean for $950. It wasn't always this way in America. I'm not going to tell you there's some mythical, wonderful past. There's not. You know, we live in a society where striking coal miners, including children and women, were machine gunned in Colorado. And somebody told me today that happened here, too. Strafed, I guess, by the Air Force. We live in a society that's always had struggles. We live in a country that enshrined slavery in the Constitution. But you know what? We got rid of slavery. We haven't finished cleaning up the mess that it left behind, but we got rid of it. Women didn't have the right to vote. 1848, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, mother of eight, I think it's eight, found enough time to organize other women to get the right to vote. And by golly, it took over 70 years, but women somehow talked men into giving them the right to vote, because that's how women got it. You can go back into the records and publications of the late 1800s when children were working in factories, which are relatively new at that point in time. And I can show you ministers of the gospel who will tell you that it is God's plan that children should be working 6 days a week, 70 hours a week. And that if you oppose this, you don't really understand. I can show you ones that say the opposite, too. But there is no evil in our society that there are not people who will be paid to defend and defend in moral terms. Taking from those with less to give to those with more is the most frequently denounced evil, and that's not my word, evil in the Bible. That's what the Bible calls it. In fact, it says in the Bible that if you do this, your society will come to ruin. That's what the stakes are in this. We will eventually destroy our country if we don't stop this. The bottom 90% of Americans, the group I call the vast majority, from 1950 to 1975, their incomes went up enormously. From 17, and this is in today's dollars, every number I'm going to give you is inflation adjusted, went from $17,000 to more than $29,000. That's an increase of $12,000 a year after 25 years. Between 1960 and 1985, that increase fell. It fell below $6,000, fell by more than half. From 1980, the year Ronald Reagan was elected, to 2005, same 25 years, just a different period, the increase in income was zero. The bottom 90% are making the same incomes today they made in 1980. How are things doing at the top? Little different story. All of the gains have gone to the top 10%. There are some economists who are arguing that's not quite true. Even if you look at their data, it's still the vast majority of gains are going to the top. But the 90th percentile, that's not where it's going. Think of an income ladder with 100 steps on it. Everybody has a place on that ladder. It's not the people on the 90th rung who are making out like bandits. Even the people at the 99th rung aren't doing that well. Their income, the threshold to get in the top 1%, is about $350,000. That's a lot of money. But there are people in this country, at least three of them last year, whose income for a single year was over $3 billion. Somebody makes $3 billion a year and somebody makes $350,000 a year have about as much in common as a cell in the bottom of your septic tank and a giraffe. They're They're both alive. The people at the very top's incomes have been rising unbelievably. The average income of the top 0.01%, that's a tiny group of people, 30,000 people. And what's the population of the city? About 50,000? So it's more than half the population of this city. That group of people, income, has risen from about $3 million a year, or $4 million a year in 1980, to $27 million a year now. That's their average income. One way to think about this is if from 1970 to 2000, 30-year period, the average increase in income of the bottom 90% of Americans, if you measure it as 1 inch, how did the top 0.01% do? Well, it would be taller than me, be taller than the ceiling, be taller than this building. It would be 625 feet to 1 inch. From 1980 to 2005, for each dollar of real, I'm sorry, I have to do from 81 because of the way the numbers work. From 1981 to 2005, for each dollar of increased income, each person in the bottom 90% got, the top 0.01% got $141,000 per person. That's the ratio, $141,000 to one. By the way, tax levels on the bottom 90% are higher than they were back then, and at the top, they're lower. Don't blame George Bush, at least not alone. Bill Clinton signed a law in 1997 that gave the richest 1,000 Americans, the highest income 1,000 Americans, men, women, and children, a tax cut 60% bigger than all the Bush tax cuts combined. And I'm the guy, by the way, who dug this out of the public record. It's right in the official government statistics. The tax cut that was given to them by Clinton was worth $8 million per $100 million of income, and all the Bush cuts are worth another $5 million. By the way, that's 13 cents on the dollar tax savings. Your tax rates all fell by 13 cents on the dollar, right? No? Sorry about that. Now, it's not that America is poor. More than half the wealth in America has been created since 1980, when Ronald Reagan asked this famous question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? The economy today puts out about $1.70 in real terms per person for every dollar that it put out in 1980. Well, if the bottom 90% have the same income, where'd the money go? It went to the top. And it went to the top because that's the policy of the government of the United States of America. Its policy is to take from those with less to give to those with more. Through all sorts of mechanisms. There are 20-some case studies that I give in free lunch where I tell the stories of individual Americans. Some of them went broke because these government policies destroyed their business, and some of them got rich because we gave them money, we sold them assets for a fraction of their value. We allowed them to take property to the poor. And this is the last little example of that I'll give you. The Hiltons. Everybody in the world who travels at all, everybody in America knows the name Hilton, right? It's on hotels everywhere. And so we think the Hiltons made this fortune from the hotel business, right? So Paris Hilton has all that money to cavort. Wrong. Conrad Hilton made a fortune in hotels, and Conrad Hilton, the man who went to mass every morning of the week, who had nightmares that God would punish him for all the money he had, who said, my son Darren has too much money. And every time he revised his will, almost every time, he gave less and less and less to his son, Barron. Told his lawyer, Barron's got too damn much money. He left his fortune to the starving children of the earth, to the poor. He wrote this eloquent will about the obligation of those who were wealthy to care for those who were not as fortunate. And then Barron set up a plan to put a mistake in his father's will, and within days after his father was dead, went to take the money. He was thwarted at every turn. The executive of the state fought him. The IRS fought him. The Attorney General of California fought him. And then he got a particular court, which I'm very critical of in my book for ignoring the law, to write an opinion that ignored what the will said, ignored what the law said, and said Barron could have the money. That's how the Hilton family has their money. They took it from poor children. It's as bold as that. They took it from poor children. Now, we can change this. We can change all of these things I've written about. We don't have to have government policies that deny poor students an education, that force them to go into debt until their hair is my color, gray, for you're listening on the radio, to get out of that debt. But we can't do it unless people are citizens, unless they know about it. My role here is to tell people about it. I have spent the last 13 years reading these obscure and really boring government documents and tables and laws and regulations to extract this stuff and then turn it into English and find people whose lives illustrate these policies to show you how it works. I'm just a journalist. That's my job. Your job, if you care about these things, is to understand it and learn about it. And so I hope you read my books, because I have to finance this research and it's not cheap. That's how I finance it, by selling books. And then you got to tell people about it. You got to talk to them about it. You have to change our national debate. And you know what? Talking about it when you get your hair cut, or when you're standing on the steps of the church, or when you're gathered with a bunch of parents after a school basketball game, that actually changes things. Changing the nature of the debate. Writing brief, two sentences, three, four, very brief letters to the editor about issues. That changes things. Calling up talk radio hosts and being prepared, having thought in advance, even writing down what you're going to say, and making cogent points changes things. On those rare occasions when candidates for office show up at a public forum, showing up and asking questions, and maybe even a bunch of you showing up, so that when your question gets blown off, somebody else says, wait a second, you didn't answer the question. Here's the question. Changes things. And trust me, if the politicians suddenly start thinking, uh-oh, I'm in trouble, they're going to alter their behavior. Because one thing is absolutely always true about politicians. It was true in ancient Athens. It was true in Rome. It's true today. They get up in the morning, and the first thing they do is this. They put their wet finger up to see which way the wind's blowing, and if it's shifting, they begin to shift. So you're not powerless. The only thing, in fact, that we can say that's un-American is we can't do anything about it. We started this country on the principle that we don't need King George to tell us what to do. We can solve our own problems. This will not get solved in this election. It is not going to be solved in 2 years or 4 years. This is a fundamental struggle. It takes a long time. But unless we start working on it, we are increasingly going to live in a society in which those at the top get richer and richer and better off, and the rest of us are paying for their free lunch. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to gather questions, and we'll have a question-answer period for everybody. If you bring them up, we can start.
Yeah, that's what the little cards are for questions, if you got them here. I'll take yours, and we'll start with yours. What's your name?
Martha.
Hi, Martha. How are the government financial policy advisors chosen? Are you called by any federal officials for advice? Do you blog on this topic and where? Well, let me do the last one first. I don't blog, and I'll tell you why I don't blog, because it's superficial and I don't think it's important. There are lots of people who do, but I do real serious, heavy work, and it would be a diversion. And when you're my age, you got to start thinking about, you know, like Eddie Childs, how much more time you got to do what you're doing. Am I called for federal officials for advice? Sometimes I've had people call me who are sort of trying to understand something. I write a column for a policy publication called Tax Notes, which is supported entirely by subscriptions, and it's expensive. And I just started the column. I've only done three of them, but it's clearly having an effect on policymakers because all of the top policy people read it. It's generating lots of email. No, but people read my work. I mean, George Bush signed at least five laws to fix problems I described in the tax code, for example. and are the government financial policy measures chosen? Well, I assume you mean to, like, the President's Council of Economic Advisors, people like that. You know, those are presidents and all have big staffs around them, and they pick people who think they can find who will promote their policies. Part of my book addresses former Treasury Secretary John Snow and shows how his life is a testament to the opposite of what he's held himself out to be in public, and how pursuing policies that killed people made him a rich man. He didn't kill people to get rich, but he followed policies that predictably caused people to die, and lo and behold, his strategies had the net effect of making him a wealthy man. He became the Treasury Secretary of the United States. By the way, he now heads the company that you've probably never heard of, Cerebus, but one of whose divisions was the company that had all those trucks of ice that could never find New Orleans, and also had the job to fix up the lodging for soldiers and their families at Walter Reed Army Hospital.
Can we take another question over here? Does the government subsidize the practice of mountaintop removal for mining coal?
I don't know. In my next book, I'm going to look at this issue. I'm writing a book called The Fine Print. Most of it's about things you think you have to protect you, like your pension is protected, only it's not because the lobbyists have put in all these things no one's reported on. And one of the things I'm going to look at is the mining industry.
Do you see a trend toward private equity firms? If so, do you believe they're also participating in the free lunch?
Okay. Private equity firms. These are these big funds you hear about, Kohlberg, Kravis Roberts, KKR, or Texas Pacific Group, that are buying up all sorts of assets. There's clearly been an enormous explosion of private equity funds. There's nothing per se wrong with private equity funds, but here's the real danger you should be worried about. A great deal of the money in the private equity funds comes from public pension plans. What happens if these high-risk investments that can produce huge profits fail? Because high risk means there's a high risk they'll lose money. Well, I'm sorry, you have already guaranteed your police officers and your teachers and others their pensions, meager they may be. There's a lot of money and a lot of people, and you're going to have to make it up. And all across the country, there have been examples of private equity funds whose investments didn't work out, and so now the taxpayers are paying a second time to provide the same pension benefits had the government not been in these risky investments.
What could be done locally to impart local state economic policy to help resolve the gap? Reduce the gap, I think.
Okay. Well, the very first thing I would do if I were an organizer, I think, is I'd start organizing small business people. I'd read what's in my book and learn about it. There are other people who've written about aspects of this. I would gather information about these subsidies. There's a group, they're polemical, but there's a group called Walmart Watch, for example. And I would then start getting to small merchant groups and talking to the Rotary Clubs. I'm going to talk to one of the service clubs, at least one of them while I'm here in West Virginia, and I've been talking to them all across the country, and say, hey, guys, I got news for you. The organizations you're paying membership dues aren't telling you how the local government is engaged in policies that are going to destroy your little fortune, your prosperity. They're going to take it away from you. They don't know this. They are a natural ally. Go talk to them. That's one. Two, I would talk to all the public employees. They're all ticked off. You know, the school teachers who haven't gotten raises for multiple years. For example, cuts made in the level of nurses at public hospitals, or librarians who they may get paid, but they can't have any, there's no money to buy new books. Go and organize them and say, hey, look, the reason there's no money is we're giving it to the Cabela's. We're giving it to Johnny Morris, who owns Bass Pro. We're giving it to the Waltons, the richest family in America. And arouse those people.
Either in the course of researching your book or subsequent to it, have you discovered the research arms of colleges and universities, especially land grant ones, exerting political influence to obtain subsidies?
Boy, that's a really broad question. Let me see if I can address it in some reasonable fashion. A number of the big endowments of colleges, first of all, are not paying money out. If you're a private foundation like the Ford Foundation, Congress requires you to spend 5% a year in grants. But There are some big universities now that are paying more money to financial advisors to manage their multi-billion dollar and rapidly growing endowments than they're providing in aid to students, which does sort of raise the question, if you're a charity, what business are you in? Educating young people and helping them, or enriching financial advisors. All sorts of universities are getting money in various ways that have been examined by some other authors. I don't know how well. I've read some of their books. I haven't looked at this myself, but in many cases, corporations are funding things at universities, giving charitable gifts for it, and then reaping all the rewards. And one of the distinguishing factors of universities now is those whose presidents and boards are smart enough to figure out that if their researchers are doing the research that leads to the new drug or the other a breakthrough or the advancement in a mathematical algorithm that can be marketed, that the university ought to be getting the royalties instead of collecting a fee up front and turning all those royalties over to the company that made the gift.
How can we limit the power of such institutions as AEI, Business Roundtable, National Chamber of Commerce? When can we stop government from referring to citizens as consumers and customers?
Okay. AEI, for those of you who don't know, is the American Enterprise Institute. It is a what's called a, quote, pro-business conservative group in Washington. All I think we should be doing, even talking about limiting their power, people have a right to pursue their self-interest. The Walton family has an absolute right to try and figure out ways to pick your pocket legally and to get the government to tax you to give them money. You're going to pass a law to stop them from doing it. First of all, you couldn't do it as a practical matter, and secondly, that's the whole idea of America, self-interest. You can pursue your self-interest. There's a difference between selfish self-interest, all you think about is you, and we are society, where we all have to live together. You know, Milton Friedman once said that we're not a society. We're 300 million people who just occupy the same real estate. I don't agree with that, but you know what? It's not an improper way to think or an illegitimate way to think. He's entirely entitled to think that way. That's what our First Amendment is about. So I wouldn't limit those people. The answer to that is you organize, you gather information, you oppose them. You take them on in the marketplace of ideas.
The basic new wage slave movement now includes all races. If all working class Americans save a complete year's worth of consumer products, clothes, appliances, and so forth, would it have any effect on the incomes of the wealthy?
Well, there's a funny thing about wealth. It's not worth anything unless you got people working for you. I mean, if you're the Hiltons, all those hotels are totally worthless unless you've got people to make the beds and clean the carpets and take in the reservations and process the credit cards at the front desk. In fact, that's one of the key elements of capitalism, which is so far the best device we've come up with for our economy. And just as we look back at the people in the pre-mercantilist days who thought wealth was fixed, there's just so much money, and if you have a piece of gold and I don't have it, then you're better off and I'm worse off, so I think I'll kill you. You know, we know how to create wealth. We actually know, and we're learning more and more how to create wealth. Half the wealth in America created since 1980. But you got to have people do the work. Everybody can't clip coupons. There is no wealth without a lot of labor. Overwhelmingly, it's labor. Labor gives value to the capital. And so, first of all, people couldn't not buy all these things. You have to buy things in order to get by in your life. The issue to ask is, and I'm sorry if I sound a bit like an economist here, and I'm not an economist, is something called returns to capital and returns to labor. We've had enormous productivity increases in this country in the last 10 years or so. But incomes for all Americans through 2004 were lower than in 2000. For 2005, they've leveled out, and there were some people who made gains, but they're only in the top 1%. Everybody in the bottom 99% the bottom 95% is worse off, and worse off than they were in 2000. And the issue is, why aren't these productivity gains going to workers? You know, when you read about a CEO who got $100 million or $500 million for a year's work, you think he did all the work? It was all the people below him. And I had a banker one day tell me something about this. I thought it was very interesting. The banker kept telling me that almost everybody at this bank, and this was a sort of high-level manager, bottom-level executive-type person, said to me, well, I mentioned that it had been the paper that morning that the CEO of this bank had made, I think it was $38 million for the year. And it's a retail bank. And the bank person said to me, well, you know why they pay him all that money? I said, oh, well, why do they pay him all that money? Well, so long as he can persuade us to come to work without a raise or for a raise that's less than the rate of inflation, they just give him a little slice of it, and that's why he makes $38 million a year.
Could you give reasons why you're adamantly opposed to the fair tax and explain why it won't solve most of the problems you've talked about?
Sure. I'm not adamantly opposed to the fair tax. I just want people to understand what it is. There's two big tax reform proposals discussed in America. They're different, and I want to make sure you understand both of them. Let me do the other one first. That's the flat tax, the Steve Forbes flat tax, or as I call it, the Steve Forbes never has to pay taxes again tax. Because they're related in their birthplace, although the outcomes are quite different. Remember, those of you who are old enough, George McGovern, 1972, was going to send every one of us a $1,000 check every spring? Remember that? And I'll bet if you were like me, I was a young man back then, and I remember turning to my wife and going, yeah, right, where are they going to get it? And take it from us and give it back. It sounded ridiculous. And what McGovern was really trying to do was get us off the income tax and onto a consumption tax, which is what the Europeans rely on heavily. It's called a value-added tax. Every step of production, the tax is built into the price. You pass the tax forward to the next party. And you have a built-in incentive to make sure the next party pays you in full and passes the obligation along, because otherwise you get stuck holding the bag. That is, it is self-reinforcing. It has problems. All taxes have problems, but that's the concept. And $1,000 was to take care of the problem that the poor consume all of their incomes, the rich consume a tiny portion of their incomes, and you need to give back some of the money to be fair to the poor. So the flat tax was thought up by a brilliant economist named Robert Hall, who said, gee, I wonder if there's a way to do this on, the income tax. Well, under the flat tax, all wages would be taxed. But if you have capital income, interest, dividends, capital gains from selling, say, a stock or a piece of art for a higher price than you paid for it, or you're a landlord and you have rental property, no tax on that income. The business that owns the building would be taxed, or the business, but you wouldn't be taxed on your capital income. So if you're Steve Forbes, you wouldn't pay taxes again. You just take it all in capital income. Now, the fair tax is another way to try to approach this idea of let's tax consumption instead of incomes. All super wealthy people who hate taxes love that idea, because you and I consume most of our incomes. Even if we're diligent savers, we're probably consuming 75 or 80% of our incomes after taxes. But if you're making $200 million a year, $50 million a year, even $10 million a year, unless you're really crazy about gambling or you're a guy with a lot of mistresses, you can't consume all that income. You're just reinvesting it. So the fair tax would be a national retail sales tax. Everything you buy would be taxed. The government would pay the tax when it purchases things. And the tax rate, the fair tax people say, would be 23%. A lot of economists who are well-respected argue it would be more like 33%. But let's assume it's only 23%. I want you to think about your behavior for a minute, what's going to happen. First of all, if you've already saved a lot of money in the income tax system, you're going to be taxed twice after the transition. You saved all this money, now you're going to spend it. And you paid your taxes on the money, and now you're going to be taxed again under the fair tax. You've got to have some adjustment for that. Secondly, if you have saved money, I'm an aunt, so I've saved money. I tell you what I'm going to do in the fall before the tax takes effect. I'm going to go out and buy like a 5-year supply of shelf-stable foods and store them. I'm going to go buy a new car. Any furniture I plan to buy for the rest of my life is all going to get bought now. And instead of people saying, people who've got the money to do this, oh, yeah, you know, we get a new car every 2 years, it's going to be, yeah, you know, we got 1 million miles on the Toyota and we're still getting it to run. Good because we don't want to pay that tax on buying a new car. And if you're a hardcore environmentalist, this is a terrific tax, however, because it will depress consumption. But there's another aspect of this that you need to think about. Got any cash in your pocket? Well, under the fair tax, the theory is everyone will, of course, pay taxes on everything. Hi, I'm from the National Sunglass Manufacturers Association, and it's been really cloudy for the last two summers, and we're having a terrible time. We're going to have to lay people off, Congressman. But, you know, if we could just get an exemption for sunglasses from, say, May 15th till July 15th, why, then we could keep all these people employed, and then everything would be right. You're going to still see that kind of nonsense going on. It's not going to go away. And you're going to see this. You go in to buy those sunglasses. The government has discovered there's a significant evasion problem. Lots of people who used to slip into buildings and furtively buy drugs are now furtively slipping into buildings and buying mink coats or designer dresses. And there's been a proliferation of yard sales going on out there, and the police, there just aren't enough police to catch all the yard sales going on. So the government's enacting a new rule tomorrow. See this greenback? We're going to make those illegal. We're going to issue you a new government purchasing card. Everything you buy, there'll be a record made of, so there's no tax cheating. Oh, by the way, the government will now have a record of every purchase you make, every place you've been, everything you've done. Warning to people, however, there might be virtuous things to it, you know. You're in a divorce case. Interesting what your spouse might be able to get from those records. Or you're in a lawsuit with somebody. I mean, all sorts of nefarious things. Your privacy is going to be gone. Now, that doesn't mean we can't have a fair tax. There's nothing the Constitution says we can't have anything else. But when you tax consumption, you're violating the Athenian principle. You are taxing everyone at in a way that puts more of the burden further down. And the transition to it, I think, would be awful. But if people want to do it, if there's support for it, it'll happen. The promoter of this tax, I want to point out to you, Neil Bortz, he's not an economist. He's not a government finance expert. He's a radio entertainer. And if you want to trust the whole welfare of the country to the insights of a radio talk show host, go right ahead.
A long time ago, Mark Twain said, imagine you're an idiot. Then imagine you're a member of Congress. Oh, but I repeat myself. This is a complex material. How do we educate congressmen and senators? What role would public campaign financing have on the attempt to educate our representatives?
Okay. Well, first of all, I don't think we should denigrate people in public service. Okay? I think we should treat them with a lot more respect than we do. It's nice to have to make jokes, and I have fun with members of Congress. But, in fact, we should be encouraging our best and brightest young minds not to go become tax lawyers because it pays a lot of money. And I say this as someone who's about to become a tax law professor at a major university. I'm not a lawyer. But people who go into public service, whether it's being police officers or social workers or members of Congress, we ought to honor them for their service to their fellow man and the way we treat them. However, we need to recognize that imagine for a moment you are a member of Congress. Well, here's what your day is going to be like. You're going to get up in the morning and your staff's going to say, well, Congressman, here's what we've got. There's a 7:15 meeting with so-and-so from, if you're on the banking committee, the American Bankers Committee. And then there's a 7:45 meeting with someone from the insurance industry. And then there's a, and all day long, you're going to have meetings with people who represent those people who have a financial stake in the government's rules. And none of them are going to come to you and say, I want you to rig the game. I want to cheat other people. I want to thwart the competition. They're all going to come in and say the same thing to you. We found this regulation or rule, and it's just not fair. And all we're asking for is to be treated fairly. Well, unless you're an expert in these fields, you're not going to know what's going on. And if you depend on those people for campaign contributions, then you're going to be doing their bidding. Now, the classic rap against publicly financed elections is the incumbents will get reelected forever. I think we talked about that earlier. It turns out in the two places that have experimented with this, Maine and Arizona, that's a limited experiment, but Maine and Arizona, what they found is the voters are throwing the rascals out. So that the major fear about it may not hold, and I think it would be very interesting for us to experiment more with publicly financed elections to see what happens. There's no reason we can't change the rules of our elections. Not all countries have these winner-take-all elections, for example. Well, there are different kinds of voting systems that may produce better results, and we should be spending some time looking at that.
Can we do two more, David?
Yeah.
My preacher told me I cannot vote my pocketbook. I have to vote the Bible. How can we convince fundamentalists not to vote the Bible?
Well, first of all, you want to vote the Bible, vote the Bible. I mean, it's your choice to do what you want to do. I would point out to you that the Constitution has a specific provision that says there will be no religious test. And despite all the nonsense that you're hearing from various preachers of the send money to me and make me rich and God will reward you because God wants you to be rich nonsense crowd, at least, you know, that's not in the Bible that I read. We have a line, this line in the Constitution for a reason. The founding fathers all understood what happened when you lived in a society with an official church and the rules of that church. Anne Boleyn lost her head over this. People were persecuted over it. And they were all believers that you should be able to believe whatever you want to believe and the state shouldn't interfere with you. You know, Thomas Jefferson wrote a book, Jesus is Not God. Didn't get published in his lifetime, but it's out there. Many of them were deists. You know, they figure if there is a God, he sort of set the universe in motion and went off on vacation. And so, you know, your vote is your vote, and you should, first of all, exercise it. I think it's awful when people don't vote. But you should also vote what you think is the appropriate policy and the vote for the people who you think you like, whoever they are. Over my lifetime, I have voted for people who were in the Peace and Freedom Party, and I have voted for people in the American Independence Party and the Constitution Party. I've voted for people all over the place. And you should vote for those people and those policies that you think are in your self-interest, because that's the theory of the United States of America.
I kind of scrunched these two together. What prompted the consolidation across many industries in the 80s, and what type of subsidies are effective in promoting economic development?
Okay. Boy, what prompted all this consolidation? Well, there's a phrase, monopoly. We were all taught monopoly is not a good thing. There's a related phrase, monopsony. That's where you only have one buyer instead of one producer. It's not perhaps a good thing either. But you don't have to have a monopoly to jack up prices, reduce competition, and reduce the quality of goods and services. All you need is what's called an oligopoly. How many big American automakers were there in the 60s? Three. Studebaker went down, I guess maybe four if you count American. And they were able basically to all charge the same prices and produce amazingly similar products. They didn't really have to compete. They compete a little here and there. You know, 1955, Ford tried to sell safety. Didn't work. But they tried. Why would you want to be in a market with 35,000 banks if you could be in a market in which three banks control over half the credit card industry? So what happened and continues to happen is government allows these enormous mergers that create and eliminate competition. And when you eliminate competition, you raise prices. XM Radio and Sirius, the government's probably going to allow them to merge. One company, a monopoly on satellite radio. And to the extent that government will put its thumb on the scale for you, of course you want to do that. And then part two was about subsidies. What was the, read me the nub of it.
Which types of subsidies are effective in promoting economic development?
Okay, well, they're not retail subsidies. Retail is the end of the food chain. It is, I mean, I can show you specific cases here and there where retail development, subsidized retail development led to some improvement, but it cost somewhere else unless there was real growth, and if there was real growth, there's no need for the subsidy. Or the phrase, if it's a sound investment, the market will make it. If it's an unsound investment, why should the government force you to pay taxes to subsidize it? Now, the best returns to a society come from, research, basic research. That's the biggest single thing, understanding the universe, how it works. How many people in this room have not ever had this experience? This will be a real age determiner. You've been in a car that threw a rod. Okay. Cars don't throw rods anymore. In the 50s, 40s, 30s, 20s, they did that all the time. Why? Big advances in metallurgy. Put your money into basic research. Algorithms that gave us computers. Rocket science, quite literally. Vaccines, genomic research, things like that. Those all produce big returns. Then you want to put it into infrastructure, and I don't mean an on-ramp built for Cabela's. I mean a canal, a highway, a sewer system, a water system. Fundamental things that service the wealth-creating function of society. All wealthy societies have large public infrastructure investments because it takes a lot of public investment to create wealth. Education, especially higher education. Why were we giving money to Cabela's? Well, they get $115 million in this state, is my recollection. It's in my book. When you could have spent that money to provide students who earn straight A's with maybe a year's free education. Who's getting a return from that? The Cabela family in Sydney, Nebraska? Well, the state could be getting that return from its own citizens. And yes, some of them will move away, but if every state does this, then it evens out. Education. You don't want to put it into retail. That's the single most important lesson. If it's a sound investment, the market will make it. If it's not a sound investment, why should you be forced to pay taxes to subsidize it? So,
David, thank you so very, very much, folks. Please fill out your evaluation forms for us, and David will sign books if you wish to have him sign it. Thanks for coming, folks.
Well, wasn't that? Well, for starters, the information was scintillating and certainly dense. Who you heard was David K. Johnston, author most recently of Free Lunch, and previously of Perfectly Legal. Dense information, valid information, valuable information, and oddly enough, somewhere along in there, a few words that I myself have said in the past. The dialogue begins at what happens at the checkout line, at what happens at the gas pump, at what happens at the basketball game, the football game, the PTA meeting. That's where it begins. So it would appear that we are in agreement. Very strange that Don Blankenship would be here this evening. I guess he didn't get the red meat that he was looking for because David K. Johnston didn't. He said he's looking at the mining industry now. He didn't say anything particularly damning about it this evening. On the other hand, he got out of here. Got up, left, and got out of here without being confrontational or saying boo to anybody. Except he did look down at the little mixing board. Hey, buddy. And I just sort of turned away. But that's it for this evening. I hope you enjoyed the program. I'm sorry about the odd length. If you will, but we'll be doing this again tomorrow evening. I hope, you never know what the questions will be afterward for that one either. So, thank you for joining in. It doesn't look like it will be necessary to preempt Peter Godbold and Strictly Confidential if, in fact, he's able to go. If not, Agnes, do me a favor, please, and fire up a rerun of Peter if he's not going to go. I'd appreciate it. We've got a lot of packing up and wires to put away and so forth. And broadcast man and production boy will be back at the mansion here forthwith. So that does it for this evening. That being the case, I'd like to thank the sponsor of everything that happens on the Head On Radio Network. I'd like to thank Cold River Mountain Watch, the hardest working, bravest people that I know. I'd also like to thank Seneca 2 for the opportunity and the invitation to come and broadcast and record this program. And all in all, I'd like to thank you most of all for joining in and listening. Like I said, we'll do this again tomorrow evening. Hold on just a minute. Let me check something, just for a second. Okay, I saw someone slipping out of the room, and I wanted to get him over here for a conversation real quick. Jesse Johnson is here. I saw you last time at the event for Ray McGovern.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, you were even trying to get the Green Party nomination for the presidency.
I was.
Well, sorry about that, but still.
That's okay.
Nice run.
It was a good experience, and I got to get the message about West Virginia out to the country at large, and particularly our message in regards to mountaintop removal and trying to switch to a new coal economy is what my plan is.
Well, and that's the important part, and that is that you are the Mountain Party, Green Party nominee for the governorship of the state of West Virginia on the November ballot. You've already qualified. You're going to be there. Your name's going to be there.
That is correct.
For those of us, and I'm a hardcore Democrat. I'm a liberal Democrat. Mm-hmm. I'm a take no prisoners Democrat. I've got no truck for the conservatism or Republicans, that kind of thing.
Sure.
I'm vociferously opposed to mountaintop removal. Mm-hmm. That being the case, I want to give you just a moment to talk to Democrats, to talk to progressives, talk to liberals, and tell them why it's why voting for you is the, because see, I'm going to vote for you in November.
Well, thank you very much.
Tell people why that's the right thing to do, even for registered Democrats.
Well, because I don't believe that the two-party system, frankly, is really working for the people anymore. Mountaineers are always free, but presently I don't believe that we actually have those freedoms of choice. And that's why it's so important, and thank you so much for having me on the air.
No,
because it's been very difficult, the media blackout that I've been having and experiencing, and particularly while I was out and speaking all over the country. I was on the Jim Bohannon show, over 300 outlets. He's like the number fifth most listened to show in the country.
Sure.
And of the five stations in West Virginia, it didn't air on any of them.
Yeah, not so much.
His show was supposed to be aired. So
Wait. I thought you were going to say, well, you know, they won't play my music in my old hometown. You know, you can't get on with Hoppy or any of the stations around here. But you're telling me that the show that you did with Jim Bohannon was blacked out in West Virginia?
Well, it didn't air, and I can't say who pulled that plug or why exactly, but it did happen. And so that was a very disturbing thing after I had contacted a lot of people within the party and put out the word, put out an email blast, so people could tune in, had them check their station, and certainly the CBS network that he, plays over.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those listings listed five stations in West Virginia that would be carrying it, and to my knowledge, it didn't air on any of them at any time. And
why am I not surprised?
Well,
I mean, I'd like to be surprised, but I'm not.
Right, I understand. But you know, when you ask that the principal question that you asked there, today you have this two-party system, and they can really stack the deck. Big industry can stack the deck and put Republicans in Democratic clothing and Democrats in Republican clothing, whatever it takes to get their corporate agenda across. And that's greatly what you were hearing here tonight, of course. And so when you go to vote, I think it's so imperative that you vote your values. Because whoever ends up in the office, whether they're placed there, whether they actually win, or whatever, they have to pay attention to the populace, the citizenry that votes its values. If a huge segment believe in Plan A or a huge segment believe in Issue B, then if they vote those values, then whoever is in office has to stand up and recognize that if they don't acknowledge them, and they don't acknowledge those votes, that they won't be in office very long.
Well, I take it that it would be your position that those values of progressive liberal Democrats, people who live on real live honest to God budgets and things like that, that those values haven't been reflected in the last 4 years.
Certainly not the last four, and I would even go further than that. My heart is out for progressive Democrats because they really have no place to hang their hat.
Yeah, well, there is that thing that says, you know, they'll vote for us in the end because what are they going to do? Vote for some, guy who believes that the earth is just slightly younger than the recipe for bread? There's no way I could go in and vote for, say, the Republican nominee for governor in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
The guy's dumber than a handful of homemade stupid. I mean, he just is. I mean, Russ Weeks minded. You don't have to do that. I'll do this part.
Thank you.
But I've got to find some point in time where, especially on a state and local level,
mm-hmm.
Where I feel like I'm actually participating in the political process, Jesse. Because, well, everybody who listens to this program knows that we come from Fayette County,
mm-hmm.
and I've explained that I have absolutely zero political representation in Fayette County, West Virginia, because with the exception, quite possibly the exception of the Fayette County Commission, everybody else is indebted to or beholden to the destruction that the coal industry wreaks on this state. My children will have to find jobs out of state because this place is not going to be a fit place to live in another 20 years if the fellow that walked out of here a few minutes ago
mm-hmm.
gets his way.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a place to be raped. Substantively, Jesse, how do we save West Virginia from that fate and that future?
Well, that's why I talk about a new coal economy is one issue. And that requires us to stop blowing up mountains. And in the process, you know, when we blow up a mountain, we're also releasing all of the methane gas into the atmosphere, which exacerbates the greenhouse gas effect by 26 times.
Okay? Holy cow.
So you're also losing 100 to 120 years of, you know, coal bed methane energy, a cleaner form of energy for us to be producing. So leave the coal intact, leave the mountain intact, tap and
drill the gas.
Drill the gas out and frack that coal seam and get that energy and produce cleaner energy. And that would be the closest thing to a true clean coal that we could experience. Secondly, going back and putting miners to work. You know, when you put miners to work, then this country and certainly this state flourishes. And when you're blowing up a mountain with 12 to 20 person crew,
mm-hmm.
well, you go back to deep mining, do it safely, follow the rules.
Do it organized, do it union.
Exactly. And you do that, and you're putting more than six times the amount of workers, you know, to work in that particular site. So then, instead of taking that coal and pulverizing it and blowing it into a blast furnace to keep these lights on, you know, this is a finite resource. You know, and when this state runs out of coal, what are we going to do?
Tumbleweeds.
You
know? Tumbleweeds.
And so what we've got to really focus on at that point is stop blowing that pulverized coal into a blast furnace and take it and create the more than 5,000 products. I know this sounds redundant. I was talking about it in 2004,
mm-hmm.
talking about a new coal economy then. But the fact of the matter is there's more than 5,000 products that can be made from that. We have a dying manufacturing base in this country. Steel has left and gone to China, and
sure,
it is not coming back.
And it's it was followed by 50% of the coal that's coming out of this state. Now, you talk
right.
about it trying to keep the lights on,
mm-hmm.
and that is the meme that the coal industry uses. But the fact of the matter is 50% of the coal that comes out of West Virginia is metallurgical in quality,
mm-hmm.
and it is going to China, and it's blowing back in the form of mercury and filth in the air that's hitting our Pacific coast.
Precisely. And so what we've got to focus on is instead of creating energy with coal, we create a new manufacturing base. We make carbon foam and carbon fibers to encase that foam. And the United States military has proven the fact that they can create almost indestructible vehicles, super lightweight, and, you know, nearly indestructible, soundproof, etc. And we can be doing that too. Imagine GM, you know, who's almost, you know, the last shovel of dirt is not quite in its face yet. But imagine GM embracing you know, those kind of composites for their manufacturing. You want to see people get back to work. Let's do what we do in this country best, and that's innovate.
What about
you heard Mr. Johnston talking about, you know, research and development today. Mm-hmm. During the Bush years, we went from about 6% to less than 2% of reinvestment from corporations into R&D.
What about alternative energy sources, the wind and solar? I'm sure you're familiar with the Coal River Wind Project right
mm-hmm.
now.
Yes.
What part does that play in a West Virginia future that you would be part of?
Well, it could be a huge part, frankly, once again, I say innovate beyond that. I mean, beyond these giant turbines are these incredibly fascinating new constructs of using hydrogen or helium balloons of various sizes with turbines that wrap around them. And then the tether is the power line, and you set those aloft at 1,000 feet where the wind is constant.
Mm-hmm.
And you can power a building. You can power your home.
Or individuals can get off the grid because...
Totally off the grid,
right.
Absolutely. And that is sustainability. That is, no matter what happens with our prices of the gasoline, et cetera, in the future, which we have a very uncertain future in this country, those are innovative answers to set and power our lives and make sure that we don't have to make changes in our lives that are so drastic we can't even recognize ourselves. And unfortunately, today, we hardly recognize ourselves as it is as a country.
What about the cleanup job of the mess that's already been made? What about places like Marsh Fork Elementary School?
It's huge. It's a huge problem.
You know, people call them sludge dams, sludge lake. There's seas of pure poison.
Absolutely.
How do we begin to approach that cleanup, and how do we avoid hanging it on the taxpayers? You know, what we heard today tonight from David K. Johnston is that without fail, everything gets hung on the taxpayers.
Always.
And it's not the, you know, it's not the Rockefellers and the Hiltons and so forth. No, it's you and me. Mm-hmm. And we wind up paying through the Superfund sites and things like that. We wind up paying for it. How do we make a sustainable West Virginia that isn't toxic in the first place?
Well, coal companies that put children in harm's way are the ones who should be paying the bill, not the public. But, you know, what we have to do is do things more smartly. And we have to do things with sustainability in mind from day one. And that's what we're not doing in any way, shape, or form. The ability of West Virginia to innovate and to lead the way for this country to come out of the position that we're in is enormous. Because, you know, we are dead last.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can do it, anybody can. And we can be a model for this country.
And we have the ability to turn not only this state but this nation around in terms of employment, in terms of long-term job growth, in terms of productivity. And bring a lot of that back. And I love these ideas you're putting forward. Because I'm painfully ignorant on this one, what is your background? How do you come to this? Do you wake up one morning and say, gee, I want to be governor? What happens?
No. I have a life, you know, I was privileged to grow up in a construct of public service familially. My father, my brother, I come from a long line of law officers and educators. And... So the educational part, you know, is something that it was just instilled in me. I'm a voracious learner,
mm-hmm.
and I went into the arts because and that's another thing I want to bring is arts and back into the school system and civics. The other part,
sure.
to how do you build a sustainable citizenry? You have to educate them. You have to teach young people what this, you know, what being an American. Or being a citizen of the United States of America is all
start
about.
With the Declaration of Independence, work through the Constitution, and go from there.
Exactly, and I would very much like to, you know, I'm one of the sustainable programs I've tried to bring out of my Green Party aspirations was a program for the police officers. Frankly, because you know they're sworn by the Constitution to serve and protect, and they really. Have very little knowledge of what's in the Constitution, unfortunately.
And we see that in some of the excesses and the abuses that are the daily fare of, well, programs like mine, the people knocking down doors. And frankly, there's been a sort of a laissez-faire approach to it lately where, you know, you know, constitution. We don't need no stinking constitution. And we're seeing it out of the courts, and law enforcement behaves accordingly.
That's right. And I certainly, you know, I have the utmost respect for law enforcement officers. There's no question about that, as I do educators. But, you know, we really have to get back to these fundamentals of the Constitution. And we cannot allow unconstitutional judgments. We cannot allow unconstitutional laws. We cannot, after you take it to the police officers, it needs to be taken to our state houses and Congress. And they all need to do some brushing up on what is and what is not constitutional.
It looks like there needs to be a general reading of the Fourth Amendment to the Congress of the United States based on what recently happened with FISA.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was egregious.
Where did you grow up? I mean, are you West Virginia native?
I am a 10th generation West Virginian, actually, or actually of this area, which, you know, predates West Virginia. I grew up in Charleston. My father was a City of Charleston police officer for a quarter of a century. And my brother was a Kanawha County Sheriff for 26 years and is now the police chief of Mason, West Virginia, actually. My family, a lot of them came from Lincoln County, where I still have a farm. And another side from Somers County, but I went into the arts. I became an actor, and a lot of people they get riled up about actors getting political, and you know, that's their constitutional right to be political.
Well, sure it is. We've seen what family ne'er-do-wells getting political have done. So why the heck not an actor?
And well, the other thing is sometimes people think that actors are airheads or, you know, are not very bright. But the fact of the matter is that an actor actually has to not only know his character and know all the circumstances for a character, but literally to get up and perform live on stage, he has to memorize an entire book.
Yes.
Word for word. Not dropping a single word.
I'm a frustrated actor myself, so yeah.
So that's not easy, and it requires a little bit of cerebral capacity. So I think that it was kind of a natural step. And then you look at Ronald Reagan. Well, you know, I mean, the other aspect of an actor getting up and running for politics, participating and running for office, is the fact that you are constantly dealing with large crowds of people, and that's second nature to an actor as well. You feel comfortable there.
Well, I'll let you go real quick because I know you want to talk to David K. Johnston.
Mm-hmm.
But I really appreciate you taking time to chat with us.
Thank you.
And you're welcome on the program, and you're welcome on the network anytime. But let me just ask about the Mountain Party.
Mm-hmm.
The Mountain Party has an automatic placement on the ballot because it got enough votes in the last election to merit
2004.
In 2004 to merit placement on a 2008 ballot.
That's correct.
What is happening with the Mountain Party down ballot? You're obviously running for governor, but are we see how easy it is? I'm getting real frustrated with the Democratic Party.
And you're not alone.
What's going on down ballot? Because I've argued time and time again to people who are fascinated with the third party process, and I say that with no derision,
mm-hmm.
but I've argued that the way you build a viable third party is by getting people elected county surveyor and county commissioner and mayor, and because pyramids are not built sitting on their points.
Absolutely. But as in most constructs of government, it's a little bass-ackward in regards to how to stay on the ballot. And a lot of people ask me, well, Jesse, why don't you run for mayor, or why don't you run for the House of Delegates, et cetera, you know, something you can win. Well, the fact of the matter is if I hadn't run in 2004 and I weren't running now, then the Mountain Party very well may cease to exist because it all hinges on the gubernatorial candidate.
Sure.
And so no other statewide election counts,
right,
as far as maintaining that ballot access. And if you look across the country, you know, third parties in general, that ballot access is the most valuable thing that you can have.
And West Virginia is one of the most difficult states to get a third party or an independent on the general election ballot in the country.
It is one of the more difficult. There are certainly those that exceed our difficulties here, like Texas.
Sure.
You have 75 days to get 65,000 signatures, you know, some things like that. But we have our largest down ballot this time. We have, you know, we have had one person who has actually obtained office, the mayor of Richwood, Bob Henry Baber, who is now the chair of the Mountain Party. We have, you know, more people now. We have about four times as many people as we had when I ran in 2004.
Now, do people register Mountain Party just like they would register? I mean, is there a checkbox there?
Absolutely.
On the voter registration?
Absolutely, just as there is on the ballot, and make sure that I hope they all see it on the ballot, you know, this November.
Sure. Well, Jesse Johnson, thank you very, very much for coming by.
Well,
and
thank you very much.
Like I said, I'm not kidding. I can't, and in this particular instance, I'm proud to say that my gubernatorial vote this November is not going to be a matter of choosing the lesser of any evils. You're offering a positive message, you're offering a positive vision, and you're offering a little bit of excitement and something opposed to the just drab, worn out, business as usual garbage that we get out of Charleston. So, yeah, I'd like for lightning to strike, and I'd like to see you there giving a state of the state and put a little dose of salts in the legislature and shake them up and see what foams over.
Well, we have the opportunity to make history once again in West Virginia, and you know, and thank you so much for your kind words, and you know, and I tend to say, you know, in regards to the old adage of, you know, voting for the lesser of two evils. Well, if you do that, then you're still voting for evil.
For evil.
And
sure.
If you do it cycle after cycle after cycle, it becomes progressively more evil. And that's really what we're kind of facing today. I'm not saying that the people who hold office are evil people, but the whole system has become so corrupted and to the point where we hardly can recognize.
From the finance to the lobby to the...
Absolutely.
Before you go, can you address the lobbyist issue and the corporate money issue?
We have more than 100 times more K Street lobbyists in Washington today as a result of the Bush administration than we ever had before.
Well, I heard Mr. Johnson a little bit ago, 35,000 lobbyists in Washington, D.C., that's bigger than most towns in West Virginia.
Exactly.
And that was
Absolutely.
The first thing that hit me. But I mean, will Governor Johnson administration, will it push for clean elections, for instance?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We will have public finance elections in the state of West Virginia, and that way you will have true representation of the people,
healthcare.
By the people and for the people. I have a health care plan as well. I have a plan for education. I want lifelong learning for our people, not just the students. You know, learning is
sure.
something that he touched upon this as well. You know, whenever you have the capacity to lift the whole infrastructure, then you've got a leader in society. And we used to be that in this country. We used to be.
We abandoned the field.
But we no longer are. And we used to be a powerful citizenry, but we have abdicated our responsibility of stewardship as citizens of this unbelievable experiment that we were granted by our founding
fathers. We were winning and we walked away.
That's exactly right. And that's what we face today. And my gosh, you know, I mean, what a waste that would be.
I've got a feeling you and I could go for 3 or 4 hours here because there's a lot of common ground between us.
Well, with your invitation, I may come up and take you up.
You
on
know,
that.
The phone works from anywhere, and
okay.
I got three hours. It's all yours anytime you want it.
Well,
I got more
much.
Than 3 hours. I got all the time in the world that you want because we've got it. We've got to talk about this new kind of politics, and we've got to talk about new kind of citizenry, and we've got to talk about the way we raise our children and make them feel about their country,
exactly.
about their state, about their county. And I wish you the best of luck. Quickly, website.
Jesse, the numeric for WVGOV.org. Jesse for WVGOV, all one word, .org.
Okay, great. Jesse Johnson, thank you so very
thank
much.
Thank you, and I certainly appreciate this.
Oh, this is a pleasure. And I tell you what, when we shut this thing down, we'll talk a little bit more off air if that's all
okay,
right.
Good.
If
that's
you're still
fine.
Hanging around.
Sure.
All right.
I just wanted to go in and talk to Mr. Johnson.
Absolutely.
For,
absolutely.
Before he takes off.
Okay.
Thank
Take
you.
Care. And that is West Virginia Mountain Party and Green Party gubernatorial nominee Jesse Johnson joining us for a few minutes. I've seen Jesse here at a couple of these events, and I really wanted you to get a chance to hear him because he's the real guy. He's the real deal. So that's the program for this evening. We will catch up with more stuff on the morrow. We'll catch up with it also. We'll pick up with David K. Johnston in Beckley as well. That's the show for tonight. We've pretty much, we're pulling up about 5 minutes short. Let's call it 5 minutes short. But at any rate, thank you to everyone. And most particularly, and let's see if this actually works. RMR, Gina. And no, it didn't. It's all for you. Imagine, and now, thank you. Thank you, everyone. Imagine the music in your heads, please. No, Ferg, nice try, but we'll talk to you all later. It's time to load out, all right? Bye now.